Thank you very much, Jack. We're looking at the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. And last week I passed out a chart. I want to try to orient us to where we are on the chart. The chart is in three sections, the top, the middle, and the bottom. And the portion that we have on the screen is this section right here, middle section, right side. Last time, we did something that I thought was kind of hard to follow because, I mean, we're bound by the text of the Scripture, so we didn't have any choice but to do it. But it's hard to follow when, with virtually every verse, the people change, but they have the same names as the people in the previous verse. So hopefully this will be easier because in verse 21, we got down to talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, which is familiar to us because we talked about him quite a lot in chapter 8. This is an overlay in chapter 11 to what we saw in chapter 8. We have more information about him here. But remember, the Lord is giving us this information not just to give us random world history. It's about how the empires of this world affect his own people, the people at that time that were living in the land of Israel. And so he gave us verses from Alexander the Great clear down to Antiochus Epiphanes to tell us, to try to get us historically to this one who became the tremendous persecutor of God's people in the second century before Christ. And we were introduced to him again in verse 21, a vile, despicable, contemptible person. And we've gotten down to, I believe, where we were looking at verse 23. So we'll just take it up there, and there's quite a bit of emphasis on him because he was such a persecutor of God's people. Verse 23. And by the way, I should show Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes is right here on the chart. And we'll be talking briefly also about these Ptolemies. The Ptolemies were down in Egypt, and Antiochus was up in Syria. So you're aware of the land around the Mediterranean Sea, I think. Maybe I should have made a chart of that map. But Syria is above the land of Israel, and Egypt is below the land of Israel. So Israel is right in between. And I have compared this to Israel being the rope in the tug of war between the Ptolemies in the south and the Seleucid Empire, which Antiochus was the head of at the time we're discussing. So we'll be talking a little bit about Ptolemy the sixth, Philometor, Ptolemy the seventh, Euergetes, also called Physcon, and there's a lady named Cleopatra that's not the famous Cleopatra, but we'll be having to mention these people as we go along. Verse 23. After the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Now, this is referring to Antiochus Epiphanes. We're kind of picking it up in the middle of the story here. But from what we learned about him in chapter 8, I think we have enough to go on. Antiochus is campaigning against Egypt. He wants to rule all of Egypt. He'll take over the whole world if he can. But now his goal is to take over Egypt. And he does this, and we saw some of this in previous verses last week, verses 21 and 22, that Antiochus operates by intrigue. He functions through flattery and deceit. And with a comparatively small army, he won a significant victory there. He captured Memphis in Egypt and also most of Lower and Central Egypt. And again, by Lower Egypt, we mean that part closest to the Mediterranean Sea. We mean the northern part, which would instinctively seem like Upper Egypt to us. But since it's lower in elevation, the Nile flows from the center of Africa up through Egypt to dump into the Mediterranean Sea. So it's a lower elevation, therefore it's called Lower Egypt. He captures most of that, and he established as friendly a relationship with his defeated opponents as he possibly could because that made them easier to rule. Antiochus showed kindness to the Egyptians and tried to do everything he could to win the hearts of his foes. He pretended to back the cause of Ptolemy Philometor. And remember, these people are all intermarried, so they're related. He pretends to back the cause of his one nephew, Ptolemy Philometor, against the cause of his other nephew, Ptolemy the 7th Euergetes, or Physcon, whatever you want to call him. And the nephews finally see that their uncle was practicing deceit and thereby becoming strong with a small people. Verse 24, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. When it says here that he shall do that which his fathers have not done, I think it's referring to what he did in Lower Egypt, which is that northern part. It was well known, of course, for its fertility, and still is in our own time, the richness of that land. These are the provinces, the richest part of Egypt is what Antiochus captured. And he would lavish on his troops a distribution of the plunder that he had taken in conquest. This his forefathers had not done and did not do. So that's what that's talking about here. He shall do that which his fathers have not done. And in this way, he purchased more influence, more loyalty from his army. But as usual, when you're dealing with mercenary forces, people that are there because they're paid to be there, it accomplished only a superficial loyalty, and therefore his advantages were only for a time. That is here a short time, for a time, the last phrase of verse 24. While Antiochus was busy fighting down in Egypt, Jason, and remember from last week, Jason was the high priest. He's up here. Jason was the high priest because he had offered the most money to be the high priest. He raised an army and raided Jerusalem. Menelaus, whom we also have mentioned a couple times, he's right here and he wants to be high priest too. So there's a conflict between these two men. Menelaus beats off the attack. Jason had, at this time, has been displaced as high priest because Menelaus bid even more for the high priesthood than Jason did. Jason thinks he's still the high priest, but he's been ousted. So Menelaus is the high priest as far as Antiochus is concerned for the time being. Jason tries to take over the high priesthood again, tries to take over Jerusalem. Menelaus beats off the attack, but it becomes obvious to Antiochus that a lot of the people in Jerusalem and the surrounding area, a lot of the people in Judaism in general, are still opposed to Hellenism. They're still opposed to being Grecianized by the Syrian control in the land of Israel. This troubles him. Antiochus goes back to Jerusalem, and what is left of the temple treasury is placed at his disposal by Menelaus, who is hanging on to the high priesthood by the skin of his teeth, and he is courting his favor. Menelaus is courting the favor of Antiochus because he knows that the Jews don't like him. Verse 25. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. I think I read the wrong verse there. I read 26. Verse 25. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, the king of the south being Ptolemy. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Antiochus is forced to return up to Syria to quell a revolt up there. And the angel that's telling chapter 11 to Daniel, the angel predicts that Antiochus is going to raise a great army and go against the king of Egypt again. This is the second campaign, and it was at this time that Antiochus came as close as he ever came to subduing the empire of the Ptolemies. He never did take it over, as we saw back in chapter 8. The king of Egypt has made elaborate plans for defense, but he was defeated by intrigue and treason on the part of those of his own court. So now to verse 26, yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. They that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, I think probably is referring to a couple of fellows by the name of Linnaeus and Eulaeus, because they were the guardians and the state ministers of young Ptolemy Physcon. He was a very young man, so he needed people to advise him, and their names were Linnaeus and Eulaeus. They that feed of the portion of his meat, in other words, the ones that he is supporting, will destroy him. They were betraying Ptolemy Physcon to his enemies. Ptolemy Physcon and Cleopatra had allied themselves against Ptolemy Philometor, their brother. Cleopatra is the sister to both of these young men. And they're doing this to try to defend Ptolemy's rule of Alexandria. Verse 27. Both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Will Durant is the man who said men lie most when they govern states, and that seems to be the case. You look at our politicians today, and they'll just lie with a straight face at the drop of a hat. They're so used to doing it, it doesn't seem to affect them at all, no matter what political party we're talking about. They just lie because it's more convenient to lie than to tell the truth. This has always been the case. So Antiochus calls a truce, and he meets Ptolemy Philometor at the conference table, and they have this conversation. Antiochus pretends to be conducting his campaign against Egypt in order to help Philometor regain total control of Egypt, and Philometor sits there and nods his head, pretending to believe Antiochus. So it's all pretense, it's all intrigue, nobody's telling the truth. Antiochus wins a decisive victory over Physcon and Cleopatra, but the deceitful deal to overthrow Physcon does not prosper. Physcon retains possession of Alexandria, and Philometor has to be content with just half of the kingdom of Egypt to rule over. Yet the end shall be at the time appointed, we're told. Even though Antiochus and Philometor would pretend to be in an alliance to conquer Egypt, it failed, I think primarily because in God's providence, it just was not yet time for the end of the wars between Syria and Egypt. I don't know how hard God pushes his providence on people. I suspect it's at varying degrees at varying times. But he's able to weave together people's personalities and natural events in order to have things come out the way that they ultimately are supposed to come out. Verse 28. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Returning to his land with great riches, this is Antiochus. He's laden with the spoils of war. He returns up to Syria, his own land. But to get there, of course, from Egypt, he has to pass through the Holy Land. And it is called the Holy Land. In Old Testament times, it was considered the Holy Land. I don't think it's Holy Land today, but it is considered the Holy Land in the Old Testament. He was developing more and more of a hatred of the Jews because they were so recalcitrant. Enough of them wanted to follow the law of God that they were very hard for him to deal with. First Maccabees chapter 1, and about verses 20 through 28 records Antiochus's plundering of the Holy Land. And the Jews that were reading what we call Daniel chapter 11 back in Daniel's day were supposed to understand that when this trial came, and all through the years they had Daniel 11 to read, and as they got closer to the time, it became more and more applicable to them. They were supposed to understand from reading this that this trial from Antiochus was only going to be temporary, and that in God's appointed time, it would end. Verse 29, at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. At the time appointed within the providential schedule of God. We're talking here now about the third expedition of Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the IV, against Egypt in the spring of 168 B.C. He didn't fare as well on this campaign as he had before. In fact, this is the one on which he was really humiliated. In Egypt, these two brothers, Ptolemy Philometor and Ptolemy Physcon, had gotten together. They were no longer at odds with each other because their sister, Cleopatra, had persuaded them that their interests lay along the same line. So come on, we're family, we're siblings, we ought to be able to work this out. And you shouldn't continue to allow Antiochus to control the situation. So these brothers got together, they took counsel with one another, and they sought the support of a growing power, a growing entity, and that was Rome. They sought the support of Rome. And because they did that, Antiochus decided that he better attack right away. So he does attack. Verse 30. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Therefore shall he be grieved and shall return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. The ships of Kittim shall come against him. Kittim is actually Cyprus, and Cyprus was controlled by Rome. So the Septuagint translation just rendered this verse, the Romans will come. That's what's seemingly indicated here by talking about Cyprus, since it was controlled by Rome. And what happened here is a famous historical episode that has often been retold. In fact, I told it to you when we talked about chapter 8. A man by the name of Pompilius, he headed the Roman embassy at the time. And this Roman embassy encountered Antiochus down in Egypt when he was besieging Alexandria, attempting to take it. And Antiochus greeted the Roman and wanted to be friends with him. He put out his right hand to Pompilius, but Pompilius, instead of shaking hands with him, he slapped into the hand of Antiochus these documents containing the decree of the Roman Senate, which said that Antiochus was to end the war against Ptolemy immediately. These two Ptolemy brothers had gotten together and gotten the Romans to come down and do this. Well, as I said when I told you this story a few weeks ago in chapter 8, Antiochus hesitated. He said he's going to need time to think about this and consider it. I'll need to talk with my friends and counselors. That's when Pompilius reached down with a staff that he was carrying, and he drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus right where he was standing, and he said, "You give me your answer before you step outside that circle." Well, Antiochus had lived in Rome for 14 years as a hostage while he was growing up. He knew the strength that was there, and he knew that strength was increasing and not abating. So he wanted to keep the Romans appeased. He didn't want to fight the Romans. He knew he couldn't fight the Romans. So he regretfully gave his word that he would withdraw from Egypt immediately. He was enraged to have to do that, but he didn't see any other options. And when you don't have any other options, you do something whether you hate it or not. So he's enraged, but he goes back home sort of with his tail between his legs because he cannot withstand the power of Rome and his cousins, these Ptolemies, his nephews, have put one over on him here by having the Romans come down there. So he has to go back home through Israel again, and the rage that he's unable to vent down in Egypt, he now turns against the people of Israel in a way he has never done before. He occupies Jerusalem in 167 BC in a Sabbath day attack where he knows that the Orthodox Jews will not fight back, and he slaughters large numbers of Jews. He destroys the city walls. The Acra is built on the site of the citadel so that they can keep control over what's going on in the temple area. Antiochus was assisted by Menelaus and his apostate followers. Antiochus had regard unto them or intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant, as we saw here in the text. Verse 31, an arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Arm shall stand on his part. The Acra there in the temple compound area was garrisoned by a large force of Syrian soldiers, which was expected to keep the Jews in submission to the policies of Antiochus. And this is how one of Israel's very darkest times began. A systematic attempt was now made to Hellenize the country by force. There was an edict that went out from Antiochus demanding the fusion of all nationalities in the Seleucid Empire, and that covered a lot of different peoples. Remember, from India clear over to the area of Phrygia. A lot of different peoples, but all of them now are to be one people. They're all supposed to worship the same gods, the Greek deities, the same mythological Greek gods and goddesses that you may have learned about in school were to be worshipped by all these people. At this time, there was an Athenian philosopher sent to the city of Jerusalem to supervise the enforcement of this order. And he identified the God of Israel, who was worshipped by the Jews, as being the same as Zeus. And he's to be worshipped under the form of Zeus. And he ordered a bearded image of Zeus to be set up on the altar of the Jewish temple, and so it was. Some people say that this image of Zeus had the face of Antiochus Epiphanes, and knowing Antiochus as we do, we can well imagine that that could possibly be right. Anyway, the Jews spoke of this as the abomination of desolation. Later on, a couple times in the New Testament, in Matthew and Mark, Jesus uses this expression to refer to the time when the Romans are going to come later. He's using this symbolism about Antiochus Epiphanes to describe how it will be when the Romans come and eventually destroy the city of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Because everybody knew the history of this time. In Jesus' day, everybody knew the history of this time. It was a dark time for the Jews that wanted to be faithful to God. Syrian soldiers and their paramours performed licentious heathen rituals in the temple courts. Swine were sacrificed on the altar, which was, of course, anathema to the Jew. The drunken orgy that was associated with the worship of Bacchus was made compulsory. All the Jews were required to do this. Jews were forbidden to practice circumcision. They were forbidden to observe the Sabbath. They were forbidden to observe the feasts of the Jewish year, all on penalty of death. You do any of these things to keep the law of God, we'll just kill you. Copies of the Hebrew Scriptures were ordered destroyed wherever they were found. And if you have an interest in this time, you might want to read in the Maccabees. There's quite a lot about it there. The Maccabees are not inspired, of course, but they do write about this time. Verse 32, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." The Jews who followed Menelaus into apostasy and in welcoming the paganization of their religion and their society were encouraged by the deceit and flattery of Antiochus's people to become even more degenerate, even more apostate. But on the other hand, the pious Jews suffered extreme tortures and left examples of strong courage and strong faith. A couple examples of that. One aged scribe by the name of Eliezer was flogged to death because he refused to eat the flesh of swine. A mother and her seven children were successively butchered for refusing to pay homage to an image. Two mothers who had circumcised their newborn sons were driven through the city and finally cast headlong from the top of the wall. Such loyalty to the laws of God in the face of suffering just fanned the spark of freedom in the hearts of the pious Jews. And this is the spark that would eventually turn into the flame of the Maccabean family that we talked about when we looked at chapter 8. Verse 33, "They that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days." They that understand among the people. Daniel is being told here that in the midst of all the paganizing of the covenant people of God in the centuries to come, there was always going to be a faithful remnant of wise people. It might be small, but it would always be there. In the Maccabees, they're called the godly ones, or the Hasidim. 1 Maccabees 2:42, for example. These godly ones will teach others the way of God, but many of them will suffer much for their faith. I think that places like Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 through 40, can have reference, at least in part, to these kinds of times, where it talks there about how the people of God were treated by their enemies. Verse 34, "Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries." The little help here, I think, probably refers to Judas Maccabeus and his sons, whom we talked about back in chapter 8, whose efforts were valiant, but they were never really able to end all the distresses of the people. Because lots of Jews who didn't really believe thoroughly in the Maccabean revolt and their cause played the hypocrite. They just joined it because they didn't want to be classified as an apostate, but yet they kind of wanted to be neutral, but we'll join the Maccabees because we don't want to be an apostate. So they didn't really have the strength of conviction throughout their ranks that they would have liked to had. Verse 35, "Some of them of understanding shall fall to try them, to purge, to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed." The suffering of this remnant had to endure, and it had to have a purging and purifying effect. It didn't take long for the hypocrites to be distinguished from the godly ones. That always happens during persecution. The people who really are sincere and mean it start to stand out because they're the ones that will endure to the end. The time of the end. He's talking about the latter days of God's people. This will occur in the second century before Christ. Daniel's writing back hundreds of years before this. We've learned in the book of Romans from the Apostle Paul that they are not all Israel who are of Israel. Not, in other words, not all of those who are descendants of Abraham are actually the spiritual offspring of Abraham. Romans 9 verses 7 and 8. And that's what we have happening here and really in any other time of persecution. All right, now in verse 36 we enter into a rather controversial section. I don't know that it needs to be controversial, but it has turned out to be. We have no apparent transition in the text here. I'll just read verse 36. The king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. We've got no apparent transition in the text here. So to me, the most obvious way to interpret this is to continue to refer it to Antiochus Epiphanes. And same place on the chart there. Antiochus, in his proud imagination, had conceived of himself as being a god. He magnified himself above every god, plundering temples. He had this inscription made of King Antiochus, God manifest victory bearer. He commanded all the national religious systems under his power to be united in one which he himself decreed. And he blasphemed the name of Jehovah. That's part of this idea of indignation that we had back in Daniel 8, verse 19. The indignation belongs contextually to the time of the successors of the He-Goat, or of Greece. And this is, Antiochus is one of those. So to me, this is King Antiochus Epiphanes here. But we should be aware that there's a lot of controversy about this last part of chapter 11. I just don't see any indication whatsoever of a change in the subject. But some take this to be about an Antichrist that's to come in the future, or about the Pope, or about the Romans. There is a note on your big, it's on both of the charts. You can actually see it on the big chart. I didn't put it on any of the pieces of the chart that I have on the slides here, but I'll just open it up and let you be aware of it, because it's one of the few things that I don't agree with on this chart, but I thought there's enough good in the chart that rather than reinvent the wheel, I just pass it out to you anyway. But right here in the middle of the top section, there is a note that I want to note with you, because I don't agree with the last part of it. I'll just read it. References to the prophecy of Daniel 11 found on this chart indicate the probable historical fulfillments of this remarkable prophecy, which reaches from Daniel's own time, the beginning of the Persian period, not covered on this chart, through Alexander the Great, and culminates in Antiochus Epiphanes, Daniel 11, 21 through 35. This last sentence that I'm going to read you is the one I don't agree with. This terrible personage becomes the type of that future Antichrist to whom the prophecy jumps in the following verses, chapter 11, verses 36 through 45. I don't see that to be the case. I don't see any reason to make that assumption. To me, this is the same as they do. And I'll just give you a little context here. The only place I know of I can get these charts anymore, and I've gotten them at various places through the years, but the only place I know of I can get them now is from the daughter of John C. Whitcomb. Bill was asking about this. I was mentioning it to him privately beforehand. John C. Whitcomb and Henry Morris together wrote what I consider to be the granddaddy of the modern creationist books in 1961, the Genesis Flood, which did a lot of good. And since that time, there have been many other books written along those lines. But John C. Whitcomb did a lot of good work in that. But all of these people, Morris and Whitcomb and their families, were and are premillennial in their thinking. These are the people who, as we discussed in chapter 9, and some of these are very good people. Kim Whitcomb is just as sweet as she can be when I order these charts from her over the phone. But they are premillennial in their thinking. They are the ones who take the 70th week off of the 70 weeks. And after 69 weeks, they take that 70th week off to some undetermined as yet future, when there's nothing in the text, as we saw in chapter 9, that indicates that we ought to be doing that. As I said when we looked at chapter 9, the 70th week is the 70th week because it's the week after the 69th week. You don't take it off and put the church age in between. It just doesn't make sense. And these are nice people. They've been good to me, but I just have to tell you the truth about this part of their doctrine. When they say that this is, that he suddenly becomes the type of that future Antichrist to whom the prophecy jumps in the following verses, there's no explanation offered for where they get that except that it fits with their previously held doctrine. So to me, it just makes more sense to continue to apply the rest of this chapter to Antiochus Epiphanes. And I thought about going through all these charts and just marking out that final sentence, but I thought you could do that with your chart if you wanted to. Cheyenne? Oh, Chris got the mic.
I had a footnote on my Bible that mentions Matthew 24:15 when Jesus is talking about the great tribulation to come and says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel, then blah, blah, blah. So it's, I think the footnote's implying that because of what Jesus says in Matthew, therefore Daniel must be talking about something after Jesus' time.
Yeah. And Jesus did apply that expression, abomination of desolate, to something after the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. He was applying it to the time that the Romans came and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, culminating in 70 AD. That rebellion of the Jews from 66 to 73 AD, really the highlight of that from the Roman point of view was the destruction of Jerusalem. So Jesus used it to apply to that. These premillennial folks that I was just speaking of, and I don't want to disparage them personally in any way, but I don't agree with their premillennial doctrine because it's not a biblical doctrine. You can disprove it biblically in quite a number of ways, and we've talked about that before. But they will take Matthew 24, which you were reading from, and Mark 13, the parallel passage, and Luke 21, another parallel passage, and apply most of those chapters to some great coming time when the Antichrist is going to rule. Whereas I believe if you take the time of the destruction of Jerusalem out of Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, you're left with a pretty short chapter. Yeah, there's a few things in there about the end of time, but those don't start coming in Matthew 24, for example, until at least about verse 35, I think. So, and that's an excellent question, yes. But I do believe that this expression was used and that Antiochus Epiphanes did become a type of the Roman desolation later. And I can see that very strongly in Scripture. But to talk about a future Antichrist, when the Bible, I believe, and when we talked about chapter 7, I even put Antichrist on the screen, and we talked about the biblical meaning of that, as I understand it at least, that the Antichrist has already come and is on the earth now, as I understand it. And when we get into chapter 12, we'll talk about that a little bit more. But he's already here. He's going to exist into the future, but he's already here and has a lot to do with the Roman system. Chris, were you going to say something? Okay. Does that answer that, Cheyenne? Thank you very much. Yeah, Jack?
I was just thinking that as you talked about Antiochus proclaiming himself to be God, you also had mentioned that he was in Rome for 14 years as a captive, and that was what Rome did. All their emperors were, what's the word, made deity upon their death until we get to Julius, and then he claims deity during his life.
Right. Yeah, the Roman emperors weren't even doing it yet. They started doing it later, absolutely. But Antiochus maybe gives them the idea, hey, you can do that. Yeah, good point, Jack. Thank you. Anybody else have a question, comment, or thought? Well, I appreciate us being able to stay together as a class. I think the rest of this refers to Antiochus. I just wanted you to be aware that there's a lot of controversy about it. When you talk about this type of thing, if you do with some friends, many people in our time, in our country, in our time and place, who have any interest in Daniel 11 at all, their primary interest is going to be this last part because they think it's still to come in the future, in our future, about the Antichrist. So, to me, the most honest and obvious way of understanding these verses is just to refer them to Antiochus. He was proud as he could be. As Jack has reiterated, he thought he was the only God. And he called himself a God, and he magnified himself above every God, and blasphemed the name of Jehovah. So we're told here that Antiochus would do according to his will, and that that would occur until the God-determined end of the time of indignation. Antiochus is going to behave with extreme arrogance. He's going to prosper only until that indignation is accomplished and ended. He's not going to be restrained through any moral convictions or religious sensitivities. Verse 37. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. His only regard was the God of his choosing, and that had to do with military power. His own lust for rule and riches dictated his religious preferences, not anything from conviction or anything about his ancestry that had been passed down to him. As Jack has reiterated, Antiochus lived in Rome for 14 years, where he had learned to despise the Syrian gods because they didn't help him while he was in Rome. He had learned to prefer Jupiter and the other Roman gods. But secretly, he had a contempt for all religion except for the religion of military power. That's what spoke to him. The desire of women here, I believe, is Artemis, as the Greeks called her, or Diana, as the Romans called her. She was a special deity, had a tremendous temple in Ephesus, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And Antiochus actually attempted to plunder a temple of Artemis in Elymais, which is in Iran today. So he had no respect for the desire of women, and Artemis or Diana. It was thought to be a terrible thing to invade one of these temples because then that god or goddess would be after you, but I don't think Antiochus even believed in the reality of those gods. Verse 38, in his estate shall he honor the god of forces, and a god whom his fathers knew shall he not honor with gold and shall he honor with gold, knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. Antiochus was going to accept bribes and grant favors accordingly to satisfy his greed for power and wealth. But his trust was in fortifications. His trust was in war. The taking of fortresses is really what he makes his god. I think that Antiochus Epiphanes, from everything we know about him, undoubtedly was a madman, Epimenes, as the Jews called him. He arrogantly defied every god that was known and unknown, except for military power, and that's why he backed down from Rome, because he knew about their military power. He attempted the paganization of the world. He was crafty, deceitful, capable of any treachery to serve his own purposes. And my belief is that in verses 40 through 45, we have a general summarization of the whole warlike career of Antiochus Epiphanes, especially against Egypt and Israel. The reason he's given so much print here is that he is so much the adversary of God's people. God is interested in his people. He's always got his eye on them, looking out for them, even when he has to punish them. He's loving them and still delighting in them on some kind of level, but he's punishing in them as God, as a father punishes the son, in whom he delights. So, I think this is just a summarization here. I'm going to go ahead and read some of this, and then we'll go back and talk about it in a minute. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. And he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. We may not have all the historical data about the final days of Antiochus Epiphanes. The historical record is somewhat spotty on this. We don't have any historical records about a fourth Syrian campaign against Egypt, with details to fit the context here. But that doesn't mean that such a campaign did not happen. The silence of history does not prove biblical prophecy untrue. The silence of history only proves the silence of history on any given point. So are we only going to believe Daniel when we can check him against uninspired historians? Hasn't Daniel already checked out in every detail that was verifiable? And it's perfectly possible that when more history is uncovered, as we find, it seems like almost every year anymore, from the archaeologist spades, we get more information. When more history is uncovered, we often find more biblical statements confirmed and more prophecy being able to be understood better. Think of the history of the Hittites, who used to be unknown except in the Bible. But now I've got a book at home this thick that hardly refers to the Bible because it's just dealing with the Hittites archaeologically and what we've discovered about them. Think of King Sargon, one of the most impressive of the Assyrian rulers, and yet there was a long time where he was only mentioned in the Bible and only one time in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah. And people would say, well, that must be some name for somebody else, or he didn't really exist, just mythological. Then we found his palace, and we know a lot about Sargon now. So more of that type of thing can happen at any time and help us to understand this latter part of Daniel 11 better. But I don't know why God's prophets always have to be considered wrong when there's any kind of a question. Why not give the prophets the benefit of the doubt, if doubt there be? But parenthetically, I should tell you about this. And I mentioned Porphyry back on April the 2nd, our first night together studying the book of Daniel, April the 2nd. It seems like a long time ago now. But I should just mention this in parenthesis, that it does seem that Porphyry, the philosopher, did say that there was a fourth conflict between Antiochus and Egypt. And that would fit right in with what we have here. And he said it was in the year that Antiochus died. When I mentioned Porphyry to you on April the 2nd, the very first night of our study, I said that probably he was the first unbelieving, significant critic of the book of Daniel. He's the one who, at a very early date, alleged that it was written by somebody living in Judea at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. According to Porphyry, predictive prophecy is impossible, but he's the one who mentions this fourth conflict between Antiochus and Egypt. The 15 books of Porphyry are lost, and we have only fragments of his works found in the commentary of Jerome on the book of Daniel. The statement of Porphyry that's referred to by Jerome is contrary to the otherwise universal testimony of history about the last days of Antiochus. So my conclusion of that is that it's perfectly possible that Porphyry falsified history, in other words, wrote down something that he knew wasn't true, just to make it appear that this portion of the book of Daniel must have been written after the events referred to. In other words, he's trying to demolish the idea of predictive prophecy. He's trying to diminish any respect that anybody would have for the prophecies of Daniel. And so possibly he makes up this fourth Egyptian campaign because it fits with what we just read there in verses 40 through 42 and so forth, which I think is just a summary event. However that may be, that was just a parenthesis, and whatever else you think of Porphyry one way or the other, I think this section is just a recapitulation of the life of the one who's called the Contemptible One, who was predicted at the end time of the Jews' indignation. A lot of what we've already said about Antiochus Epiphanes when we studied chapter 8 and when we talked last time and when we talked tonight is just fitting well with this summary. This recapitulation of his reign makes the prophecy end in a more emphatic manner. After all, the persecution by Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the most important events any time in the history of the Jews. Among all the crises to which the Old Covenant people of God were subjected, This time of Antiochus Epiphanes can only be compared with the captivity in the time of King Nebuchadnezzar. The return of the exiles has definitely been foretold by Jeremiah. Jeremiah's prediction was known by Daniel. It was pondered by Daniel, as we saw in chapter 9. Daniel saw clearly that all the tyrants of the earth are under the control of the God of heaven, and that the kingdoms of this world are foreordained by him. So Daniel encouraged God's people, not merely in his own time, but he is encouraging us. He's encouraging God's people in all time to be steadfast in the middle of fiery trials and deadly perils, in view of the certainty that God will eventually crush the tyrants and deliver the innocent for time and for eternity. So to go back to the chart for just a minute, we're almost done with the chart, but I'll read verses 44 and 45. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas of the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Talking here about the end of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was attempting to put down the Maccabean revolt, and at the time that he was most strident about this, he received news from Parthia and Armenia way off to the east, and he found that insurrection was spreading in the east and the north of his empire. So he set out for Parthia and Armenia to quell the revolt there, but he left Lysias as regent and guardian of his young son, Antiochus V, who ruled after him for a couple of years right there. But he's not ruling yet. But Lysias is looking after this boy who's going to be Antiochus V. But before he left, Antiochus gave orders to completely depopulate Judea, just slaughter the Jews. Antiochus Epiphanes is attempting here what has never been proposed by a Babylonian or Persian conqueror, the entire destruction of the Jews and their religion all at once. And in 2 Maccabees, and maybe I'll just read you a little bit about that. I keep referring to the Maccabees, but I haven't really given you much of a flavor. Just a little bit here from 2 Maccabees chapter 9, beginning in verse 4. I'll read down through verse 10. Talking about Antiochus Epiphanes at this time. Transported with fury, he conceived the idea of making the Jews pay for the injury inflicted by those who had put him to flight. And so he ordered his charioteer to drive without stopping until the journey was finished. He's tried to deal with things in the east, and now he's headed back to Jerusalem, and he's going to kill all the Jews there. At least that's his goal. But riding with him was the divine judgment. For in his arrogance he said, "When I reach Jerusalem, I will make it a common graveyard for the Jews." But the all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him a fatal and invisible blow. As soon as he had said the words, he was seized with incurable pain in his bowels and with sharp internal torments, a punishment entirely fitting for one who had inflicted many unheard-of torments on the bowels of others. That's a reference back to, it's a common thought, that one of the ways he had of treating the Jews was to have his soldiers take red-hot pokers and poke them up through the rectal cavity of the Jews until that poker came out of their mouth. Just a horrible thing. That's what's being referred to here. Still, he did not in the least abate his insolence. More arrogant than ever, he breathed fiery threats against the Jews. After he had given orders to speed up the journey, it happened that he fell out of his chariot as it hurtled along, and so violent was his fall that every joint in his body was dislocated. He who, in his pretension to be more than man, had just been thinking that he could command the waves of the sea and weigh high mountains on the scales, was brought to the ground and had to be carried on a litter, thus making God's power manifest to all. Worms swarmed even from the eyes of this godless man. And while he was still alive and in agony, his flesh rotted off, and the whole army was disgusted by the stench of his decay. It was so unbearably offensive that nobody could escort the man who only a short time before had seemed to touch the stars in the sky. Now, that's 2 Maccabees. It's not inspired. You're not obligated to believe it. And there's probably some hyperbole in that account, but it gives you a flavor of the story of Antiochus as depicted in the Maccabees. I summarized that back in chapter 8, but that's the first time I've read it to you. Chris, go ahead.
Oh!
I'm sorry. I've gone past the time. I'm sorry. I try so hard not to do that. I guess we didn't get done tonight. Sorry. I'm sorry. Well, okay.
Let me just.
Sometimes I just forget what time it is. I'm sorry. This is the first time I've done that. I guess whoever's got the announcements, it's all yours.